considering the first one?
There is a conflict.
Wait, so we have to put a conflict amendment in?
Yes. So we'll do that first.
Okay.
If that's okay with you.
We're on.
Then we'll do 865, and then we'll do 27 and 925, current.
Well, as far as I'm, 865 falls where it falls. I'm at the point where I'm tired of trying to help people. Especially after yesterday.
The Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue is open. Good morning, everyone. We will start with a bit of committee business and open up a work session on House Bill 2129 for purposes of a conflict resolution. We have an amendment we have to send through.
Mr. Chair, I move that the vote whereby the committee passed HB 2129 be reconsidered.
Okay. In discussion, Kyle, do you have anything on this that you need to educate our audience on?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to describe kind of the conflict and what the amendment we have. So the conflict arises between House Bill 2129 and House Bill 2487. 2487 was passed out and was signed by the governor on 422. And these were assessor bill and a DOR bill. But they both of the bills had made changes to ORS 311-234. So this is kind of the change. We talked about this recently, the change in value, if value is discovered and how the assessor would make that change to the value. And the amendment language essentially is going to apply the statutory changes contained in House Bill 2129 to House Bill 2487. So it could be the 2129 language that would eventually make it into law if they're both passed. So what 2487 did is it allowed the assessor to reduce maximum assessed value if the taxpayer informs the assessor of discrepancy in the assessed and actual square footage of the value, and the correction in maximum assessed value would be reflective of the change in market value and the square footage change. House Bill 2129, on the other hand, requires the assessor to make the change. So before 2487 would allow the assessor to make the change, House Bill 2129 requires the assessor to make the change, but it's in a change determined by the assessor. It's a slight deviation from, I guess, 2487 to 2129 language, but it really does accomplish more or less the same thing. And the two parties, proponents behind the bills, agreed on these changes.
Okay, so passing this amendment is the language of the original 2129?
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chair. Basically says 2129 will be the language that becomes law.
Right. Okay. Any questions about that? We're in discussion on a motion. No further discussion. Any objections? Seeing none, House Bill 2129, the resolution conflict passes.
Do we need an amendment?
To the floor of the Senate. Do we need a do pass?
Mr. Chair.
I think we need a... You need I don't even think we have the language, do we?
Yes, we do.
We do?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Let's adopt these as amendments.
What's the amendment number?
Where are the amendments?
Are the amendments posted?
So yes, the amendments, pull it up here, would be in the 2129, should be in OLIS. We do have the dash one. And really what's this saying is if House Bill 2487 becomes law, which it already has, Section 1 of this act will replace essentially Section 1 of 2047, and they both have the same statute. So it really is taking the 2129 language, putting it into 2047, making that the law, and then removing that section that's been more or less cut and pasted into the other bill from 2129.
All right, so what we did was we just moved that the vote be reconsidered.
Scroll up.
Yeah, so we need to bring the bill back into the committee, and then the committee can pass it up, so it chooses scroll with the dash one amendment.
So we're actually in work session, Mr. Chair.
We are in work session.
And House Bill 2129 is actually before us. Mr. Chair, I move that the dash one amendment to House Bill 2129, dated 4/27/15, be adopted.
Senator Boquist moves that the dash ones to House Bill 2129 be adopted. Discussion? Objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2129 as amended by the A1 be moved to the floor with a do pass recommendation, and then I'll speak to the motion, Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist moves the amended version of 2129 be moved to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a do pass recommendation. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just looking at the red ink and the information that's on my staff measure summary from the last hearing, I just recall for the record, it didn't appear that most committee members, this was a 66% solution or a two-thirds. Hopefully this confliction amendment will improve it slightly. You'll recall, committee members, this was the issue in which we had the discussion included, for example, out in Wasco County, where there's 2,000 aerial photographs that show changes. And we're trying to hold some of these people harmless, and we all, I think, asked, almost every committee member asked that, you know, we really have a larger problem we need to fix. So I am fine supporting the amendment to deconflict it, but obviously we still have a problem that needs fixed in the future. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion? Objections to moving the bill? See none. House Bill 2129 as amended moves to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a do pass recommendation. Senator Bertschinger, you want to take a second swing at this?
Okay, sure.
Senator Bertschinger will carry the bill. We'll open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 865. Kyle, is this yours?
Yeah.
We have Senator Girard here with us today and his team.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 865 would allow a county by ordinance or resolution to exempt the first $250,000 of assessed value of homesteads of surviving spouses of a fire service professional or a police officer killed in the line of duty. The exemption would apply to all taxes, fees, and charges and assessments imposed on the homesteads located in the county. The bill defines the homestead as an owner-occupied primary residence. It requires a surviving spouse seek an exemption to file application prescribed by the Department of Revenue with the county assessor on or before April 1st of the year preceding the first property tax year for which the exemption is sought. It requires specific information to be included on the application and takes effect on the 91st day following an adjournment signee die.
Thank you. We have amendments.
Yes, Mr. Chair. We have the... So we do have just the paperwork on 865A. We do have the dash A3 amendments. We do not have the paperwork yet for the amendment language, so we are unable to work that bill with the amendment.
So it's just the are we talking about when we're discussing this bill, the one with the dash threes?
They're talking the main bill.
Just the main bill.
Right.
Okay.
A3 is a separate issue.
Would you like me to describe the A3 at this point? Or
might as well.
Okay. The A3 would expand the property tax exemption for literary, charitable, and scientific organizations to include a history museum or a science museum as defined in the amendments. And it establishes an exemption from county-imposed property taxes for the qualifying history or science museums. It requires at least 85% of the actual use or occupancy of the history or science museums property to be used for one or more of the qualifying purposes, which are then described in the amendment, and it would apply to property tax years beginning on or after July 1st, 2014.
Okay, Senator Girard.
Thank you, Chair House. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Senator Fred Girard. I represent Senate District 9. I'm here today to introduce Senate Bill 865A to the committee and ask for your support. This is a very simple bill. Until we got the amendment, by the way, but it is a very simple bill. Senate Bill 865 allows counties to offer property tax relief to the surviving spouse of the first responder for police officers and firemen who die in the line of duty. This bill also imposes a ceiling of $250,000 of the assessed value of the homestead. The exemption would include all taxes, fees, charges, and assessment imposed for the property. And it is important to point out that this bill is permissive. By permissive, I mean that if a county chooses not to do that, they don't have to do that. So counties that are strapped for cash might choose not to do that. Counties that have a little extra might choose to do something more. And at the suggestion of the Department of Revenue, the A Engross bill includes language that will be used to create a standardized application for the exemption. So, colleagues, it's, like I said, it's a very simple bill. It's basically just giving a little bit of an insurance policy for those people that put their lives on the line every day for you and I. Now, I don't know about you, but I saw the fireman that fell through, you know, the roof of the building. And I've also read about police officers on a routine stop that get shot and killed. So that's their daily life. There's just a lot of risk that's imposed on them. And this is a little bit of saying, hey, we're with you, and we're going to take care of you the best that we can in some of these areas that in the counties that choose to do this. It was brought up that what about divorce? What about the size and how it would be applied. Again, that's permissive. It's up to the county to come up with the rules and regulations on how they want to administer it. So, again, it's a very simple bill. The A3 amendment really has nothing to do with this bill, and so I was kind of surprised. It's up to the discretion of the committee if they want to impose that on this bill. This bill has no known opposition that I know of, and I would really kind of like to get the bill. So. Anyway, I'll turn it over to my colleagues at the dais here.
Thank you, Chair Haas, members of the committee, Jenna Ingram, Executive Director of the Oregon Fire District Directors Association and the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association. Both associations looked at the bill, and I'm here to voice our full support. Like Senator Girard indicated, they got down in the weeds a little bit about what if, and I explained to them it is completely discretionary, and the counties may write their policies however they see fit. We wanted to thank the senator for bringing the bill forward. The only other question that the associations had was with regard to whether or not volunteers would be included. I was able to show them in the statute the statutory definition of fire service professional, and volunteers are included. This would apply to cases such as Officer Lipke up in Clackamas. Again, we're very appreciative of the spirit of this bill. We have no position on the A3. It's not our issue. We don't care. Thank you very much, and happy to answer any questions.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, and I'm here today on both on behalf of the Police Chiefs and Sheriffs Association in support of this bill. We don't have to go far back to find a number of tragic incidences that had significant impact not only for communities and departments but for families. Whether we look at the Woodburn bombing, where we lost Officer Hakeem and Captain Tennant, or whether we look to Rainier, where we lost Chief Ralph Painter, or we've already heard Robert Lipke's name, Reserve Officer Lipke, and then just this past week, of course, we lost Deputy Gil Dayton down in Coos Bay, who leaves behind a 15-year-old daughter. He was a coach of her softball team. Thursday of last week, she pitched a game in his honor. Those are huge impacts. Our association has a committee that's dedicated just to line-of-duty death resources because we understand that the sacrifice they make is a lifetime sacrifice. We deeply appreciate this bill. It is permissive. I think that's important, but in terms of what this offers, again, to families that are being challenged in a number of ways following the death of a loved one. This is just one additional resource that I think is reasonable to provide, and I support the bill, and I thank the committee's time and attention on this. Thank you.
Thank you. It's definitely a laudable effort. I suppose the trick is in the details, like all of our bills. It does feel a little foggy in areas when you get into reserve officers or volunteer firefighters. When I look at the statute that you referenced in that first section, a fire service professional means a paid or volunteer firefighter or a member of a public or private fire protection agency that is engaged in fire prevention, fire safety, fire control. Is that your understanding of what this bill includes?
Thank you, Chair Haas. Yes, that is the intention of the bill, but remember, it's permissive, and so the rules of how it will be applied will be made up by each individual county. So it can be, they could narrow the scope if they so desired. It would be my intention that they wouldn't do that, because I think that a reserve officer killing line of duty should, you know, if it was me, they've put their life on the line. And again, this is just one of those little tributes to help ease the transition.
Thank you. Other questions, Senator Boquist?
Thank you. Senator Drudge, I'm just make sure on the main bill. Do you see or envision any involvement at the Department of Revenue with them establishing a statewide policy?
No, actually, we worked with the Department of Revenue, and that's why the amended version had a form to fill out so that it would be easy for counties to apply for this exemption. So they've already been involved in the bill, and I think they're neutral on the bill if you ask them technically.
Thank you, follow-up.
Follow-up.
And as you and I have spoke before and in the past, and I'm committed to help get this bill through, the other portion of the bill, if nothing else, we need to bring forward and highlight it out. So I will commit not to endanger your bill for the deal. The problem I have, for the record, Mr. Chair, is, as we know, far too often we get testimony from government agencies, and then, you know, what they tell us they're going to do and what happens are two different things.
Sure.
So thank you.
All right, thank you. We'll move down the list here.
Great. Thank you so much.
I have Kevin Manick signed up, who agreed to join us via telephone. So I don't know if he's been listening in. And Connor Harrington, I believe, is – are you the in-between or go-between?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And for the record, Mr. Chair, the main bill in the 8th is the A3. And the A3 amendment are, you know, distinct and separate, but in the relating clause. It's a relating clause issue. And I don't think anybody's going to be surprised by the A3 in the situation. Whether this turns out to be the mechanism, I don't know.
Hello, this is Kevin.
Good morning, Kevin. This is the Senate Revenue Office for you.
Kevin, it's Mark Hass. You've got the Senate Revenue Committee here, and your associate Connor is at the witness desk, and we're asking you to comment briefly on Senate Bill 865.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be heard. We are offering an amendment, as we have occurred to Senator Boquist and the committee, which would clarify the law in regard to property tax exemptions for historic and scientific museums in the state of Oregon. The reason for the need for this legislation is that the current law is a general statement as to property tax exemptions, and we have seen a unique situation in Yamhill County where, unlike the 35 other counties, the assessor has taken a very strong position against the exemption as to what we would argue are typical museum activities. While this is not presently the case in 35 other counties, that could serve as a precedent, and we believe it is important to have the statutes clarified so that there will not be future issues affecting nonprofit museums around the state, at which there are about 240 of them. The main intention of this amendment is to provide what I'll call a black letter law line of clarification as to property tax exemption for certain activities. There's certainly no issue about actual displays at a museum, but issues have arisen in regard to food services provided to the patrons at the museum, as to each of the museum store to provide the items for the patrons to be able to purchase, as to having a few of them which shows films which are largely connected with the museum's purpose, but I'll use the Evergreen Aviation and Space Museum situation as a specific example. There we had to go through and deal with every hour of film shown during the entire year, and part that app was there just a meeting held on the premises, and the fact that 8% of the time films were not exactly educational areas during the holiday times. Mr. Smith Goes to Washington was shown, the Polar Express was shown, even though the vast majority of the time educational films, clearly educational films are being shown, that it was argued that that's not enough for the whole invention for the theater. Even that, as to parking spaces, generally there's a statute that says if you own, if a nonprofit owns a parking lot and makes it available to the public, 355 days a year free of charge, that is exempt as part of the nonprofit's operation. But because the museum leases the land where the parking lot is located, this is treated as a subject to analysis when some of the parking lot was passed. The most significant element has to do with open space. I am speaking now specifically to the Evergreen Aviation Space Museum, which I do represent. And a large part of the campus around the buildings and the aircraft is open space to make it an attractive setting in the community, which this is right at the edge of the city. It's overlooking farmland, and there is open space out there, and the county assessor took the position, well, you're not displaying aircraft on it, so it's taxable. We think that there ought to be an appropriate room for a museum to have a campus-like setting, and I think that's especially in keeping with Oregon's land use laws, which encourage that kind of open space. So those are some of the details that are in that amendment. Frankly, we believe it simply clarifies the law along the lines of what is traditionally considered as exempt in Oregon, but it would avoid other counties following suit and difficulties for museums in the future.
All right, that's a good description. We're essentially talking about at Evergreen or at OMSI, the book sales and the gift shop sales, whether those should be subject to tax or not. Those kinds of things. Yeah. All right. Questions of Kevin Mannix?
Oh, he's in the South Pacific, I think.
I don't think we want to know. Connor, did you want to weigh in, too, or you're...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my testimony would mostly be repetitive of Mr. Mannix's. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Mannix. We'll stay tuned. I think we're going to hear from the department in a moment.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Pretty good.
Technical skills, too. CTE. Okay, so we've kind of got two things going on with this bill. Yeah, let's bring up the counties, Gil and Jeff and your team. We've got firefighter spouses, first responder spouses, and then this whether to tax museums on activities.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. The bill before you is the right thing to do. AOC supports it. The Dash 3 amendments, on the other hand, are a different story. Reading them, I'm not as deeply familiar with the facts of the Evergreen issue as Jeff to my left, but there are issues that jump right out as you read the language. The Dash 3 amendments would amend the property tax exemption statute, which is archaic. Often amended and inconsistently interpreted in its current form, and we have inconsistent applications with respect to charities and such because of its awkwardness. Exemption that the amendments would far from clarifying would be even more add even more vague language to the statute and create opportunity for even more litigation, which we want to avoid. The assessors, one of their priorities is to clean up this statute. We'd like to see it done comprehensively. Frankly, it's a mess. Some examples of the amendments that create concern as a policy matter. Page 3, lines 20 to 21, apparently grants a complete exemption to a history or science museum using a lesser percentage. This puts the assessor in the awkward position of determining the predominant use of several portions of the property and keeping track of percentages of use that are likely to change throughout the year. Page 3, lines 22 to 30 are the paragraphs that follow subsection 3. You'll note that they appear to be attempts to override legislatively adverse judicial rulings on property taxes imposed on specific areas at a specific property. This committee is being asked to change statewide property tax policy without the facts, without evidence of the need to do so, and without any information about the impacts of doing so statewide. And it does so in a manner that's confusing and very difficult to administer. Page 3, lines 26 through 28 refers to goods and services providing refreshment to the public. What about catered private events? This is another requirement for the assessor to make fluid calculations throughout the year about how much it's used, that particular function is used. Page 3, line 29 grants an exemption to property used as a theater for presentations about history or science. How frequently must the theater be actually used for this purpose? And how is the assessor supposed to monitor this throughout the year? Page 4, lines 2 and 3, what does for preservation of open space mean? It simply cannot be undeveloped acreage on a property. At the very least, preservation should mean a conservation easement or a deed restriction with substantial length and enforceability by the public. Otherwise, it's just a vacant space that can be developed at any moment. And the figure of 65% of open space seems extreme and, again, seems to refer to a specific property. You'll note that this is retroactive, so there must be some reason for that, an appeal or something that may go adversely to the proponents. Legislation, as a general matter, that is property-specific, very rarely makes good public policy. So we oppose this, the Dash 3 amendments.
Good morning, Chair Hass and members of the committee. My name is Jeff Ivey. I'm the Deputy Assessor of Yamhill County, here on behalf of Yamhill County and Scott Maytubby, the assessor, to indicate our opposition to the language as proposed in the bill. The Evergreen property is a unique property in the state of Oregon. There's a water park, there's an air and space museum, as well as a theater building with office space in the building. It is something that is somewhat of a challenge to administer the current exemption statutes with, notwithstanding what is being proposed here this morning with this amendment. Yamhill County takes the qualification of exemption applications very serious. We follow the statutes. We go through the processes that are required to do property inspections, look at books, talk to people on site. It's not just something that we rubber stamp a yay or nay on, so to speak, as far as granting property tax exemptions. There have been many trials in this case, pending, current, and probably ongoing into the future, because of some of the vague language that is in the statute. It's very confusing for the assessor's office, not only our office, but other offices, to equitably apply the statutes to properties throughout the state of Oregon. How is the assessor, as Gil mentioned, how is the assessor's office going to obtain the data on a yearly basis? Are we going to be provided with information as to income from various events? Are we going to be provided with information on when showings are happening, when outside catered events are happening, such as happens at the Evergreen Aviation Museum, where they have outside weddings, where they have wine festivals and those sorts of things that can be a big portion of the income that they receive from the property. If this legislation was to be adopted, for instance, taking 85% of the area in these buildings, there's over 350,000 square feet when you combine them all. Right now, 87% of those buildings are exempt, which is about 304,000 square feet. The other 20 plus or 30 plus thousand square feet in the building, those are used for commercial office space, rented out or leased out to private entity for-profit businesses. The language in this bill as it stands right now seems to me to indicate that that remaining 25,000 square feet or whatever would be exempt under this law. I don't believe that would be the intention of that of the law. The concession stand in the theater, Mr. Mannix mentioned, that is fully there just to provide refreshments to the folks that come look at the movies. Yes, they do show educational movies. 88% of that theater is exempt. the remaining percentage is not exempt for when they show movies such as National Lampoon's Vacation or Polar Express, or they have outside corporate events where people come in from, say, the Evergreen Aviation for-profit entity and have their corporate meetings in there. There's a time, you know, difference there. So we did go through and work with Mr. Mannix on what percentage that would be.
Let me stop you right there and sure. go through some questions here on mm-hmm. this amendment. We're a long ways from firefighter spouses here.
Sure.
But since we're talking, this is the subject here. Most of the museums are nonprofits.
Yes.
And if this applies to all of them, and I know more about OMSI than I do about Evergreen, but I know that their gift shop sales, for mm-hmm. example, one of the things, it's a nonprofit. One of the things that board is very conscious of mm-hmm. is to keep the admission prices low enough so that more families could mm-hmm. enjoy it. And if the gift shop sales helps subsidize ticket prices to the public at a nonprofit, mm-hmm. isn't that in the public good?
Well, Mr. Chair, OMSI's in a different situation, as I understand it. I'd ask maybe Tom Linhares or John Phillips to add detail if I get something wrong, but it is that gift shop is exempt, but it does sell only items that relate to what is being displayed at the museum. And I believe there was another ruling related to the square footage and the time that the average person needs to go through the museum and the appropriateness and the relatively small size of the gift shop and apparently a refreshment area, but I don't know the specifics. I do know that OMSI is exempt for that. I think the facts are different here, though, and I'd ask Jeff if he could clarify.
Yes, Chair Hassan, members of the committee. Evergreen Aviation Museum, the Air Museum, is 98% exempt. The only area that is not exempt in the building is the gift shop. And that's because not only do they sell, yes, they do sell some educational things, but they also were selling corporate logoed items for the Evergreen Vintage Airline Company and related companies. So it was not just, say a puzzle about airplanes or a little model airplane. It was other items that were logoed with Evergreen Aviation.
So their gift shop sales are exempt, and nobody's trying to change that.
The gift shop area. Exempt. In the building is not exempt. Everything else in the building is exempt. 98% of the Air Museum is exempt. The only portion we're talking about is the gift shop.
Okay.
Good. And it's very similar across the way over to the Space Museum as well. I think it's 96% exempt.
Senator Buckles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for the record, I think all 233 or 3040 museums are all unique. Right. Kind of like OMSI. But my question for the assessor or deputy assessor is, did you do the appraisal, or is the appraisal done by the Department of Revenue or done in conjunction with the Department of Revenue?
Senator Boquist and Chairman Haas, we worked for the water park. We worked in conjunction with the Department of Revenue. For the other buildings, those were added to the roll before I came there. I believe my understanding is that our department worked with the builder, the constructor, and Mr. Smith and his folks to come up with a valuation for that, for those other buildings.
And as we pointed out, this particular case, as Gil pointed out, that we have an archaic statute, right? So this is case by case. In this particular case, is the state involved in the legal action?
Senator Boquist and Chair Haas, yes, they are.
Is the state paying for the legal action?
Senator Boquist and Senator Chair Haas, I believe they are paying for the Department of Justice's attorney that is helping represent. We also have our county council involved as well.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. All right. Let's bring up the department, John Phillips, Department of Revenue.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. Thank you for this opportunity. I did get a chance to talk with Senator Girod about the bill, and I appreciate the chance that he gave us to provide some input on the details of that. And as you can see from some of the changes made, they did accept some of the suggestions we had offered. A couple of the things that we had suggested that didn't get into the bill, we would just suggest for purposes of sort of consistency among exemption statutes. And again, we are neutral on the bill and the amendments. The suggestions we made that weren't included in the changes were one of them had to do with surviving spouses. For example, you might know that the statute allows for an exemption of property tax for surviving spouses of disabled veterans, but it does limit it to those who remain unmarried. This particular bill provides for surviving spouses and does not have any limitation on marriage or remarriage, and I don't know if that's an issue for you, but we just bring it up because it is in the law for disabled veteran spouses, so I just make that suggestion. The first $250,000, I think, is what the bill calls for exemption, and for the veterans, it's a different amount. So we're always trying to encourage consistency in the exemption statutes, and so to the extent you want to make differentiations for different classes of people that you're...
What's the standard amount if there is such a thing?
Mr. Chair, good question, and it's indexed annually. I'm going to venture to say it's around $20,000, but I don't know for sure because it changes from year to year. As soon as I memorize it, a year goes by, and it's changed. Yeah. So, but I can look that up. Would you like me to comment? Okay. So on the Evergreen exemption, we've had bills in the past on this same topic, and I appreciate Mr. Mannix working with us on that issue. We did have some discussions during the interim on this. I just saw this amendment yesterday for the first time. So I guess I would comment. His concern seems to be clarity in the statute, and we are all about clarity. We would love to have clarity. One of the concerns we've had over the years, and that's why we're involved, because it's a complex case. We're involved in the Evergreen litigation because we help counties out whenever there's a complex litigation where there's a small county, maybe they have a small litigation team, they only get a large case like this once in a great while, and so that's why we're involved. This is a huge complex with a lot of records and a lot of property and a lot of different uses, and it was a concern to us, of course, that with 240,000 square feet of office space that was used consistently by for-profit companies, that we don't see that happening at OMSI. And we don't see that happening at the High Desert Museum and places like that. So it was a lot of blurring of the lines with this particular organization, so we had to look at it a lot more carefully. If you could look at it and say this is used exclusively for a museum purpose, there wouldn't be litigation. But clearly there's been some line blurring here. So that was our concern. We're also concerned about the retroactivity of it. We're concerned about the percentage use. I think it would be helpful for the assessors and the department if you just said water parks are exempt if operated by a museum, no matter what the income is. But what I think this tries to do is make the water park exempt also without saying so by using a 65% and an 85% kind of formula in the bill. So those are just some comments for clarification, and we'd hope that it could be more clear.
Could you comment on the status of the litigation, where we are, how far along, and what the points are being argued?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am not completely up to date on that. I recently read an opinion, it might be several months old, from the tax court that found that some of the areas that we had argued were taxable under current law were taxable. So, but there were also some areas that the court ruled, I believe, were that should be exempt. And so it seemed to me to feel like a split sort of decision, and that he sent it back to the assessor and the taxpayer to work out some of the other finer points, and then it will come back to the court. So, but I'm not up to date 100% on that.
Okay. Senator Boquist.
Yeah, and I have read the appeal. It's a draw, as Mr. as Mr. Phillips said. It's a draw, which goes back to Gill's point. It's an archaic statute we're still trying to figure out. In 2005, most of us that were here heard very similar issues in other arenas. So I guess my question is, and you probably don't know, Mr. Phillips, the way forward, but the issue comes down to is once DOR, you're involved, you delitigate something, you then either get a victory or a loss. If you get a loss, then it goes away, and if you get a victory, then you start down the marching road like intangible central assessment, so on and so forth. And the list of 240, of which virtually every member of this committee has museums and stuff on this list that's up on the public record, I mean, the question comes down is, what would be the next step? Because some of these do have not water parks, but some of them certainly have, we'll just say, entertainment areas, revenues, so on and so forth. And what I think I just heard you said is, yes, there's a problem, and we do need more clarity. This might not be the solution, but we do need more clarity. Is that what I'm hearing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, yes, we would be happy to be involved in conversations to bring more clarity to the exemption statutes. The charity area, 307-130, is the most complicated for us because that brings in hospitals, and the House Committee is working on that right now. There's a bill. But it just seems session after session, and as ideas for exemptions come forward, it just illustrates and punctuates the current problems we have. So, I do remember about 20 years ago, there was litigation in Coos County over their museum's gift shop, and I think a bill passed to exempt gift shops for certain kinds of those museums. And what I'm saying by saying that is that I think it's been a long time since we've had a museum litigation.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, that'll close out our witness list, and I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 365. I'm sorry, on closed public hearing on 865. Do we do 3001 here? We have the appropriate people. Okay, I want to quickly move on a public hearing on 3001 and then move to our tax reform bills where we have some new numbers. So let me open up a public hearing on House Bill 3001.
Kyle? Yes, Mr. Chair, House Bill 3001. allows application for determination of real market value and assessed value of properties destroyed or damaged between January 1st and July 1st to be filed on or before December 31st. And this would apply to property tax years beginning on or after July 1st, 2014. It also repeals redundant provisions of law, and it requires applications filed after the later of August 1st of the current year or the 60th day following the date on which the property was damaged or destroyed, but still filed prior to December 31st, to be accompanied by a late filing fee equal to $200 for 0.1% of real market value. And so to kind of put that into more summary words, I guess, would be right now there is an existing, in law, there is existing language, but it's the timing of the application that's being changed by House Bill 3001. So property tax statements, generally, they're required to go out no later than October 25th. And part of the issue that the proponents discussed on the House side was the application to have the reassessment done for destroyed or damaged property is due on the later of August 1st or within 60 days of following the date on which the property is destroyed or damaged. So that when the property tax statement comes out, it could possibly trigger an individual who has this destroyed or damaged property to realize I'm being taxed on property that's destroyed or damaged. But at that point, the application to have the reassessment has already passed. So if the tax bill that comes out is the trigger mechanism to remind someone they could have filled this out, it's beyond the timing in which they can file that application. So this law would change that to make it the deadline December 31st, but would also include a late filing fee to handle some administrative costs for the assessor at that point.
Thank you. And this is a bill introduced by Representative Esquivel. He wasn't here yesterday. He's not here today. Paul went to find him. We don't know if Esquivel's in the building.
He is. Hold on, Mr. Chair.
But yeah, we do have.
I believe he's in another hearing room.
We do have some others who wish to speak on this. Tom, is this your bill? Yeah.
Chair
Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is Tom Lynn Harris, and I represent the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. This really isn't our bill. We're actually neutral on the bill, but I wanted to just point out a couple of technical aspects. Remember, the assessment date, the date property is valued as of, is January 1st. The statute even specifies 1 a.m. on January 1st.
1 a.m.
1 a.m. on January 1st. So New Year's Eve, no assessors get to go party because we're all out valuing property as of 1 a.m. So for the upcoming 2015-16 fiscal year, property taxes due in October-November 2015, the assessment date is January 1st, 2015. So whatever was there on January 1st, if a house is half built, then we put half the value on. If the house is there, we put it on. If it's not there, if you build a house all in one day on January 2nd, you don't pay taxes on it for 2 years. So the problem that, the statute addresses, current statute, is if property is damaged or destroyed between January 1st and July 1st, it's there January 1st, it burns down January 2nd. Well, then come next November, they're going to get a tax bill for the full value. So the current statute allows for an application to say, wait a minute, I know the assessment date is January 1st, but in this case with my property damaged or destroyed, let's make the assessment date July 1st. Fill out an application. The assessor will then go out on July 1st, determine what's there, and that would be the value that the next tax bill would be based on. That's current statute. What this bill does is simply allow, like many other application processes, particularly exemptions, and I should note the previous bill, the Senate Bill 865, that doesn't have a late filing provision, so you might want to think about adding that to that one. The typical late filing provision is until December 31st with a late filing penalty, because what happens is the house burns down or the property qualifies for exemption, but the property owner isn't aware of it until they get their tax bill. And then they come into the county assessor's office and say, oh, by the way, my property burned down last January 2nd. Well, sorry, the application deadline was August 1st. It's too late. So what this would do, it would allow a late filing through December 31st with a late filing penalty.
If there was a destruction to the property?
If there was damage or destruction between January 1st and July 1st, yes. And that is consistent with exemption applications, most of which have that same late filing provision. So this would just be consistent. Because most people, when their house burns down or their barn burns down, the last thing they think about, oh, I need to go talk to the county assessor. It just never occurs to them. Now, many counties will actually thumb through the newspapers, oh, Farmer Jones's barn burned down. They'll send them an application. We used to do that in Columbia County, and I know many other counties do that. Some counties don't. So it kind of puts the burden on the property owner to know that the assessment date was January 1st, and if their property is damaged or destroyed between January 1st and July 1st, they need to file this application. They don't think about it, like I said, until they get their tax bill the following October. And by then, it's too late. Under this bill, it wouldn't be too late.
Okay. All right. Well, when people have houses or barns burned down, property taxes are probably not the first thing that comes to mind to figure out. Questions? All right, thank you, Tom.
He's on his way. He just put up with the committee, so now he's coming down. He lost the transition on the elevator.
Oh, okay. Representative Esquivel is having elevator problems.
Not unusual, Mr. Chair.
Yes, there's a joke there, but I won't make it.
You're on the record.
So we'll stand by momentarily.
Oh, Senator Bircher, you probably missed that. You didn't mention he said Senator Esquivel.
Mm-hmm. Senator.
Going to old days. Right? Not a reflection on the present representative.
Senator Boquist, do you have any comments while we're sitting here on House Bill 3001?
I was just thinking 2001 Space Odyssey, but I mean, I'm looking at 3,000.
It's a good number.
Yeah, 3,001.
It seems kind of a waste of a good number on a technical bill like this.
It does indeed. And of course, you know, when Kyle got done explaining it, I knew less than what I had before because in the economic terms, I have no idea what he was saying.
Representative, we've just been waiting for 2 days for you to show up here.
Okay. Is this a senator or a representative?
One-time senator.
Senrep.
How are the elevators down at the end of the... Are they okay?
They're fine.
They're fine. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
For the record, Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6. House Bill 3001, give you some background on that. An individual in my district had a warehouse burned down. And this happened in, I think it was around March or April. Well, he had 2 months or to August 1st to report that. Otherwise, he would be assessed for the taxation for the next year. And so consequently, we had no provision in the law to have him not pay those taxes for the following 6 months. So this is what this does. It corrects it and allows people to go clear to the December 30th or 31st, whichever, I think it's 31st, to report that instead of having to pay the taxes for the next year. They pay a fine of about $200 and or one-tenth, I believe, of the assessed value. This was at the request of my county assessor because he felt that the way the law read that he was unable to undo it. So that's what we're paying for, is to allow the counties to undo paperwork for the assessment. How many people would actually know that you have until the 1st of August to report? I mean, you don't know that. So it's one of those things that we're just correcting a little shortfall in the law.
We went over some of these things with Mr. Lynn Harris before you arrived, so we agree, Senator Boquist.
Oh, and thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. You weren't here for the other one, but we did hear in an earlier hearing today that, you know, that these whole sets of laws sometimes are archaic, so that we have to fix them on a routine basis appears to be the norm.
Well, the clue is, Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, the clue is when they're forged in stone by a chisel, you know that they're a little archaic.
Questions? Okay. We appreciate you finally coming down here.
So, thank you. Well, actually, I was just down the hall. No one told me.
This is the second hearing we had on this, and no one showed up, right?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I think we should hold that against the senator, but not the representative. Are we in a work session? Are we ready?
We are not in a work session, but we could move into one.
Do we have all
three? Let's.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. I'll close the public hearing and open up a work session on House Bill 3001.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3001 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 3001 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Just for the record, Mr. Chair, you know, I am opposed to the senator's bill, but I will support the representative's bill.
All right. Objections? Seeing none, House Bill 3001 goes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. It's my turn, and I will carry this bill. Okay. Thank you all for participating in that. I'm going to open up a simultaneous public hearing on SJR 27 and SB 925, tax reform bills. We have some new numbers as we're trying to ease volatility and straighten out property taxes and see if there's any possibilities this session to do something about some huge problems. Well,
thank you, Mr. Chair. This is kind of a, as you know, a work in progress, and updating the committee on some of the larger concepts that we've been working with. The focus of this discussion is around SGR 27, and that is it's actually a constitutional revision that calls for a repeal of Measure 50, and essentially leaving Measure 5 intact, and then directing the legislature to establish a homestead exemption system. So if you were to just make the change and do the necessary statutory accompanying language and go to the Measure 5, 5, and 10 rates based on market value, you would have an increase in revenue. However, the proposal could be made revenue neutral depending on the homestead exemption system that you set up. So we have a couple things. Kyle has worked on some numbers, and he'll come and go through those with you. These are large overall numbers that reflect rough estimates at this stage. As you know, the Measure 5 limits on our property-by-property basis, so that's So keep that in mind, that these would be preliminary ballpark-type estimates, along with some discussion around a homestead exemption. Tom Linhares is also here to talk about some of the implementation issues that would arise, and Tom would be the perfect person to talk about that because he was represented the assessors in 97 when Measure 50 was put in place. And keep in mind that Measure 50 not only has the constitutional provisions, but it also has a large amount of statutory accompanying language. So any amendment or revision like SGR 27 would require a substantial accompanying implementation language statutorily. And Tom would be Tom can talk a bit about what that might entail.
Go ahead, Kyle. Put your password in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yes, I apologize. I don't know the generic password for LRO staff. And if I put in one more time, I think it'll lock us out completely. So, but in OLIS, as Paul was just describing, there is a document, SGR 27 tax effects. And we also have it up there on the screen. And just as a couple things up front, just to describe. So SGR 27, it's essentially removing the Measure 50 language from the Constitution, and then also provides a provision for a homestead exemption. Now, if you simply remove the Section 11, the Measure 50 language from the Constitution, there's going to be some tax administrative issues. I'm sure there's some assessors behind me that could probably say that that's a gross understatement. but just as there's some, I took some assumptions and some liberties in describing the information in front of you. So it ultimately would depend upon what the implementing language would look like. But just to give you a general scope, that's what these numbers are meant to be. So just briefly, the assumptions that I made were kind of the high level assumptions. The first is district permanent rates. I assume they would remain the same. So just as a quick reminder, these were set at the time of Measure 50 based upon what property taxes were being imposed at that time. So what districts were imposing at that time, then they became a permanent rate. So districts that were imposing lower property taxes now have a lower permanent rate, and it is more or less at that permanent rate going forward. But so I used those permanent rates and would apply them to the real market value of the property. Of course, if there was some change in that, that would ultimately change what the tax imposed could be. So that is kind of a mechanism that where it could be dialed up or down. The second thing was I said there'd be no initial change to the imposed amount for local option tax levies. So these are based on rate-based levies. So if all of a sudden you start taxing on real market value as opposed to assessed value, you could increase the amount raised by local options. Now, I assume that that actual imposed amount, to say local option levy went out for $15 million, I assume that that $15 million would still be the amount that would be raised through the local option after making this change. And my assumption for that, or I base that on the idea that voters, when they go out to support a local option, they're usually given a dollar amount and the estimated amount that it'll raise on a typical piece of property based upon a certain value. So it seemed fair to hold that steady. And then the last large assumption was that specially assessed properties would remain specially assessed. So this is primarily going to be farm and forest land. I assume that you would apply the rates to more or less the assessed value or the specially assessed value of that farm and forest land. So you wouldn't be applying it to its highest and best use. As important to keep in mind, there could be farm or forest properties where its highest and best use is, say, residential property rather than as farm property, but it's being taxed as farm property. So I kept that in there. With that background, the first chart that is up there on the top of the page is really, I included that's from the Basic Facts publication that we have on the property tax background, and it just shows the assessed value and the real market value beginning with 1970 going forward to 2013, with the idea there being just to show switching to a tax based on real market value would, of course, follow the fluctuation of real market value. So it's fairly clear to see the property tax bubble that we experienced in the 2000s where RMV went up and then went down. And so if you're taxing based on RMV, revenues coming in would also fluctuate. So they would have kind of surged up there beginning in about 2005 and then fallen back down in 2008, 2009. So that would change the revenue flow from a state perspective, but also for the property tax owner as well. The bluish-purple line below there is the assessed value, and that shows more of a steady growth, and that's the value to which the rates are applied right now. So that's more or less the property tax imposed follows that steady growth.
So if we just simply lifted and repealed Measure 50 and went back to market rate, we would have at the very end of that table on the right side, essentially, we would be going up to that level, up over 20, 21. And so there would be a tax increase if we just lifted and went back to, because market rates are always are going to be higher. So that's what would happen there. About how much are we talking about? If we didn't know homestead exemption, what are we talking about there?
Yes, Mr. Chair, so in the chart right below that one, the bar chart, I ran a couple estimation scenarios, and this is based upon the fiscal 14-year data, so it's a little dated, but it's the most complete and published data that we have available to us at this point. And one thing to keep in mind, this is really more of a conceptual or high-level review. There's a lot of assumptions behind it, but it does give a good indication of what would happen. If this was in place, this change was made 2 years from now, of course, these numbers would be bigger.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, so the first block of, I guess, three three bars there shows the fiscal 14 and the revenue. So the purple column is $5.5 billion, so that represents about what we imposed in fiscal year 14. So we start at $5.5 billion. The next grouping over, it says no Measure 50, zero exemption or household exemption is the idea. You would see revenues increase to about $6.6 billion.
Okay, so would it be fair to say we'd be, if we just lifted, repealed Measure 50, we'd be raising property taxes by about $1.1 billion or thereabout?
Yeah, that is correct, yeah. Dependent upon some of the finer points.
All right, just for the record, nobody's planning on doing just that.
yes, Mr. Chair, these are all to describe, I guess, how the effects would fall out. So then I have the homestead exclusion amount. And this would be based on RMV. So it starts with the homestead exemption of $50,000, $100,000, $150,000, and $200,000. And it does show, if you switch to RMV without any homestead exemption, you're at about $6.6 billion with a $50,000 exemption. So the first $50,000 of RMV is exempt for homestead properties. So these are owner-occupied properties. Would put the total imposed at about $6.2 billion. And really, I went out to the $200,000 exemption amount because that puts you at about the same amount. So you're at $5.5 billion under existing law. Switching to RMV with an exemption, a homestead exemption of $200,000 would raise about $5.4
billion. Right. And we're talking homeowner-occupied homes?
Yes.
Not commercial.
Yeah, so these would be ones that, and it's not just an important point, it wouldn't just be all residential property, anything like that. It would be homeowner as well. So a rental property wouldn't be received. Yeah. But that's the second chart to give some indication there. Like I said, when this was put in place, if it was 2 years down the road or something like that, the numbers would be a little bit different. The last chart that I have is showing the estimated percent of tax imposed by property class. And the idea there is to show kind of the shift in where the taxes imposed would fall. So the first line at the top there, the blue line, it starts on the left part. It's kind of a line chart. It's a little confusing, but it starts with fiscal year 14. So under current law in fiscal year 14, residential, multifamily, and manufactured structures is that blue line paid about a little over 60% of all taxes imposed came from those types of property. And I grouped them there because residential, multifamily, and manufactured would be the ones that would be eligible most likely to receive a homestead exemption.
Why multifamily? Wouldn't that be rental, commercial?
It could if condominiums was kind of the thinking, if you own your own condo or something along those lines. And then the following goes through commercial, industrial is the red line, so that's the next largest at about 19, a little less than 20%. And then the smaller ones are miscellaneous tract land, farm, and forest, which are all under 10% each. And as you see, so starting with fiscal year 14 at the left side of the chart, and then you work your way to the right side, the initial change from basing tax on RMV with no homestead exemption begins to shift the burden a bit. And part of that would just be the difference between real market value and assessed value and some of those changes. So just even shifting to a real market value begins to shift a little bit of the tax burden from residential, multifamily, manufactured over to some of the commercial industrial.
Other way around.
So the tax burden, the overall, I guess, share, the total amount, a little bit more is being paid by those other ones. As you include the exemption, you can see, as you begin to exempt owner-occupied properties, the residential multifamily begins to make up a smaller share of the overall taxes imposed, and you're seeing more would be paid from the other property types. Primarily, it's commercial and industrial that's seeing the increase there. So by the time you get to the a homestead exemption of $200,000, you'd be going from, for the residential multifamily, of about a little over 60% to they're paying a little less than 50% of the total tax burden, and commercial industrial will be shifting from a little less than 20% to a little less than 30%.
So in the revenue neutral scenario, that would include a homestead exemption of somewhere around $150,000 to $200,000. Even if it's revenue neutral, there would be a shift in burden from commercial to residence.
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chair. Or you'd be shifting from, excuse me, from residence to commercial.
Yes, that's
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Tax burden. Those are pretty interesting numbers. And I think there's a pretty strong consensus that we need to either repeal Measure 50 or somehow change the language to make it more workable. It was one of the things that made the central assessment fix so difficult. It's one of the things that economic development experts have to explain to any company that wants to do business here, that this is how our property tax system works. It's there's a lot of, I think, policy reasons for removing it, but then just removing it would result in this tax increase that, if not offset, would be very, in addition to being confusing, would be just a straight-out tax increase for Oregonians. And I think there's a lot of common sense in lowering it this way through a homestead exemption. Senator Boquist?
Is there anyone else signed up? I'm curious.
Tom in here is signed up.
Tom, you want to come up, Tom?
Mr. Chair, I think one of the comments I would have is for the viewing public and for the professional staff that aren't employees of the legislature that frequent this building, and that would be that I think if we don't come up with some sort of solution or proposed solution rather than just thinking this is a game of academics, that there are ballot measures and organizations on the move that will place on the ballot fixes to this that people are not going to like, and they poll in the 70 percentile range. So to think that we're just kind of going through an academic thing here, the alternatives to either the legislature figuring out a solution are pretty draconian in some people's minds. And so I would encourage people to hone up their computer skills out there and start paying attention to what's going on. Because if we don't come up with a solution, the other solutions are going to come up themselves.
That's how we got here. Paul, in some of your computer modeling on some of our other tax reform ideas, you've had economic development feedback, dynamic feedback.
Yes.
Is there anything that exists on this in terms of what something like this would do in terms of jobs or the effect on the Oregon economy?
Mr. Chair, yes. I mean, we've looked at proposals that would have large homestead exemptions similar to what we have here. We've looked at them, though, in the context of Measure 50, not in the context of a Measure 50 elimination. So we can try to model that and look at that. That what happens with the homestead exemption is, of course, you reduce the cost of housing, and that triggers increased construction, increase in home ownership, and it also, in the models, triggers a pretty significant in-migration. So it has a very stimulating effect in the context of Measure 50. Now, with the elimination of 50 and going to the market value base, you would have some offsetting effect through the commercial industrial shift that Kyle talked about. But that's something that we could model and see what that impact might be. But the homestead exemption itself does have a powerful stimulative effect.
Good. Well, Tom, you were involved in the birth of Measure 50. Is it a gross understatement to say that we can just simply repeal it?
Mr. Chair, he's turning pale.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Lynn here is representing the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. It is true I was involved in 1997 with both the constitutional language and the implementation language. It was an interesting process. I'm still not sure how Dexter Johnson wrote all of the language for Measure 47 and 50 in the same session. A lot of the quirkiness of Measure 50 has to do with when they were writing 50, what they really needed to do was mirror as much as possible Measure 47, because they had to go out for a vote. Measure 47 had just passed in November. If they were going to go to the voters with a replacement, they had to, you know, sell them convincingly that this was pretty much the same deal as Measure 47. So some of the quirky things were put in there for political reasons more than policy reasons. Yeah, I may be in the minority, but I actually kind of like Measure 50. I'll admit that to you. Being on the front lines of the property tax system, Measure 50 does one thing fairly well, and that is bring stability and predictability to homeowners' property tax bill, which didn't exist before. Other than new construction or zone changes, a homeowner could pretty well guarantee that his assessed value will go up 3% a year. And unless there's new levies, his tax bill should go up 3% a year. So that to me is one of the best features of Measure 50. There's inequities. There's some things that just don't work very well. And certainly county assessors are starting to hear from their constituents that those inequities are problematic. Whether people would be willing to pay more in property taxes to correct inequities, that's another question. My concern about the proposal that Mr. Warner and Mr. Easton have presented is it really makes for a more volatile property tax system for property owners. If you base the value on market value and you keep the permanent rate, then if the market value goes up 20%, taxes are going to go up 20%. So combining that with the homestead exemption, maybe that offsets that. The one thing I read SDR 27, it repeals all of Measure 50, which includes the permanent rates. So if this was all that was done, essentially there would be no property tax system because no taxing district in the state would have any levy authority. Tax bases were eliminated in 97. SDR 27 would eliminate all the permanent rates. So, and obviously there's a lot of detail that needs to be added. You couldn't just pass this and nothing else. I guess my biggest point to make, Mr. Chair, is, as I noted to you last week, county assessors stand fully and completely committed to helping you do whatever it is you need to do to either repeal, fix, replace Measure 50. Obviously, we're heavily invested in the system. We're going to have to administer anything you do come up with. So I guarantee you that if you put together a work group for the interim, county assessors, county tax collectors, and I'll speak for county commissioners as well, we'll all be at the table to assist you in any way we can.
Senator Buckles?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at one of the interesting things I've seen, if we go back to 2008, you know, the market collapsed, the bubble, so on and so forth like that. As you point out, the stability of the tax system kind of, it did stay there because it's the value, that valuation. The problem I think a lot of people saw is that, especially in my district, the actual real market value of their house was now lower than the assessed value because it went down. And there is, you're an assessor originally by trade. We always hear this thing, and my kids are the same way, and they say, well, you know, you invest in your house and the value is always going to go up. Well, most houses are made of wood. This is Oregon. Especially those of us that live in the western part have a lot of rain. And so those houses eventually rot down and fall down to the ground. And so, I mean, the stability issue that we always keep forgetting, that, and I'd like you to comment on, is that eventually these houses are going to lose value because they're going to rot and fall down. They're not just going to continue to go up like this. And we all have gotten this deal, well, the housing market's going to drive the economy up and so on and so forth like that. I mean, in your experience, you know, at what point do suddenly houses, instead of going up because of their age and weathering and business codes and all your assessor stuff, do they start going down in value, regardless of what we do in the property tax system?
Senator Hass, Senator Boquist, you make a good point. Of course, I'm old enough and been around long enough that I remember the recession in the 1980s, and values leveled off. They came, assessed values and total statewide were reduced 1 year by less than 1%, if I remember my facts correctly. The recession that started in 2008-2009, assessed values total statewide declined, I think 3 years in a row, by double-digit percentages. Absolutely unprecedented. So should you design a property tax system to take that kind of recession into consideration? I don't know. But your point's well taken, because if not for the quirkiness of Measure 50 with the assessed value separate from real market value, not only did it provide stability for the property owners, but during the recession when real market values were plummeting, it actually provided stability for taxing district revenues. Taxing districts would have been hurt even more if the tax system would have been based on real market value. I don't know. Deschutes County, I mean, there even the assessed value was reduced. If the taxes would have been based on real market value, the reductions in revenue would have been even more severe. So when you're looking at fixing, repealing, replacing Measure 50, the answers you come up with really depend on where you start. Are you designing a system for the benefit of property owners, or are you designing a system for the benefit of the taxing districts that receive the revenue? Whichever focus you have, you're going to come up with a different system. The trick is to develop a system that works for both property owners and taxing districts.
Just one quick observation.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, and I appreciate you going back to the recession of the 80s, but I guess I'm in a line of work in which history makes a lot of difference, and it always amazes me, even on the floor here, where I can read where we did something in 1926 that we're now doing in this year. But I just point out that the anomaly we think we saw where the market was going down to double digits, that's not an anomaly over the last century, because at the end of World War I, we saw a 30% decrease in the housing values. Once again, at the end of the next war, we saw it. And so, you know, long term, and I have, unfortunately or unfortunately, have a house that's in that ancient category that's older than I am. And so, therefore, it is, which is ironic, because I'm paying a tax on that house today, which you would think I was in your neighborhood. But the fact of the matter is I could never sell it. Your assessor has already been out and looked at it and said, well, we're just going to kind of keep it what it is. Because if we actually did a real in-depth inspection, the building code's got to be out condemning this thing, because it's that old. I mean, you just can't get it up to code to sell it. And so I just point out, Mr. Chair, that, you know, the anomaly of housing going up like this, as was even pointed out by Tom here, that's this up and down has been going on at least for 100 years.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kyle, on your chart here, you show that farm and forest is pretty flat, though most of the farms in Oregon are family farms, so they have a resident on that. Did you pull the two apart when you did this?
Yes, Senator. What's being, I guess, this or shown in the farm and forest in the chart would be the property not connected with the homestead. Okay. So not the homestead on the property, which would also be able to qualify for homestead exemption as well.
Right. I just wanted to make sure that's the case. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions?
Mr. Chair, if I could just interject a comment around, and you see the lump there from the housing bubble and then the bust, and the Tom mentioned the uncertainty over values for taxpayers. One of the things that this did come up during the restructuring task force a few years ago, and Kyle and I were talking about it recently, there may be some middle ground where you could set up some type of a moving average, which you would base assess values on a moving average that would be updated each year with market values. So the average over the last 3 years or the average over the last 4 years, that would be data that the assessors would have. And that would give you more stability, but also would allow for flexibility in the system. So you're going to be based on market value over just a couple more years rather than a single year.
Mm-hmm. That's an idea.
I like that idea.
And I like the stimulative effect
To be honest with you, Senator Burchick, I like cutting taxes for homeowners. A $200,000 homestead exemption would wipe taxes away down to zero for a lot of Oregonians. And it's been a while since this legislature has provided property tax relief.
Well, I definitely have to run this through my assessor, because in a district like mine, where you don't have the higher class homes,
you already have property tax relief.
Yeah, this would really have property. And how would it affect the special taxing district? It wouldn't affect those at all.
I don't think we've built any assumptions into the special assessment.
Yeah.
Well, we would need a lot of separate, obviously, issue. Those kind of details. And, thank you, Tom, for volunteering your help on that.
Good work on getting these numbers. Thank you. Anything else today, Senator Riley? Then we will adjourn.